It's time for Microbrew Milwaukee Brewers Chatter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. My name is J.R. Radcliffe. I am joined by my friend and colleague, Kurt Hoge, also of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been following this team at home this week. Ugly week. It was not good. I was talking with Todd Rosiak, kind of starting to throw some World Series vibes into the ether last week. This week, you know, a little bit of a reminder that this team still has flaws, and they go 2-4 at home against two beatable teams, the St. Louis Cardinals and the Colorado Rockies. They lose those two losses against St. Louis were both in extra innings. The Rocky series, probably the more concerning of the two on Sunday, 23 straight men went to the plate and went back disappointed. Colorado, not known for their pitching. You might not know that, but they're not considered a pitching haven by any means. And, well, their pitchers kind of had their way with the Brewers. They scored 2.8 runs per game over the last five. It was a nice Labor Day, not since. So, Kurt, we're going to start, we are still focusing on the big picture because after all of that, they are still 9 games ahead of the nearest opponent, the Chicago Cubs, in the National League Central. They are still going to win the Central. No one is worried about that, I would hope. But obviously, we're keeping our eye on what this team is going to look like in a few weeks. At this point, we're 3 weeks away from the postseason, and the offense is quite stinky. So they've shown issues all year. I don't know if that is, you know, I don't know if this week is indicative of anything, to be honest, but it does sort of expose that, you know, there are really only three or four guys that have been consistently solid all year long. So as you look at this offense, does this week tell you anything? Does it tell you anything bad about what's to come? Or, you know, is it still just 1 week and you kind of throw out the data?
I don't know if it tells us anything new, but it does tell me that this is a bad time to stink.
Well, I would say it's not a bad time because it's not October 1st through 3rd. Okay. It's September. So they've still got some leeway.
Okay. That's sure.
that's my way of looking at it.
I see a 9 at the start of the date on the bottom right of my laptop screen, which to me means it is not a good time to stink. Because you want to avoid the 2021 vibes as much as possible. Not a good time to stink September.
No, 2022 vibes as well when they fell apart and did not make the playoffs. I think, you know, I think this team just, for me, it's kind of about comparison. There are no teams that truly, you know, are without flaws. And we've talked about this a lot. And so have a lot of other people. There's not going to be a 100 win team. The Milwaukee Brewers are probably not even going to be a 90. I mean, it'd be crazy. It'd be really good if they were a 95 win team. And they're probably going to land at like 90, 91, 92. And that's pretty good in the current climate. So I guess the question is, do you still believe the offense has the playmakers enough that can lead this team in the postseason, that can get hot October 1st through 3rd, and then the series after that?
I think this team is good enough. Are they talented enough?
Two different questions, I guess.
There's just a little bit of a difference in those two questions, and maybe that's splitting hairs. My wife always gets mad at me when she asks, "Are you mad?" And I go, "No." And then it's quite clear that I'm like frustrated, but I'm something else. You know, I'm like, I'm annoyed or I'm over talking, you know, like I pick a different word and she gets mad about that. And that's kind of what we're doing here, but I'm going to do it anyway. This team is 100% good enough to go on a run in October. But to do so, I think they would be doing it with one of the lesser talented teams to make a deep, deep, deep run. Like, sure, anything can happen in October, but also recent history suggests, and I don't know if this is just like a fluke or something that's true of the modern game, that the really good teams are the ones that make the deep runs. The talented teams, the top-heavy talented teams.
That's true.
The Diamondbacks were a bit of an aberration last year, and they didn't even win the whole thing. So they didn't even put up a fight in the World Series. I'm also answering this coming off just watching the worst offensive performance I've seen from this team in 3 years of covering them. That's not an exaggeration. You're playing the Rockies at home and you go 23 up, 23 down, and your only run is an unearned run because Ryan McMahon threw a little bit wide. That was really bad. And so maybe that will color some of the
commentary for us and for me. But yeah, the lineup, the individual names right now, a lot of question marks by a lot of names.
Yeah, that was a truly terrible Sunday game. It was so bad. Freddy Peralta wasn't at his best again after it looked like he'd kind of turned a corner, and he was just kind of what we've seen from Freddy when he hasn't been great this year. So that was also discouraging, I would say. I think, as I think about this offense, I don't know if any of these individual things, I don't think anything really portends anything coming when it comes to the postseason. There's no, you know, we could try to create data that says, well, teams that do this do well in the postseason. We could try. It's just not going to happen. It's going to be random every time. Other than, like you said, the really good teams, they do more often than not actually get to the World Series. And I would also say, by the way, if the Brewers were to replicate what the Diamondbacks did, get to the World Series, this town would catch fire. I know there are going to be people that are disappointed if they don't win, but having not been there since 1982, it's going to be a major, major deal. That's all they have to do to completely capture the city of Milwaukee and the state of Wisconsin.
For the next 50 years, bring them out. Every 5 years.
This does remind me, by the way, that at the end of this, I actually, Kurt, you're going to love this. I have an interview with Kelly Call, who's a name you don't know, and Gorman Thomas, a name that you do know, who is part of this documentary looking at the 1982 Milwaukee Brewers. Kelly Call is a producer, a longtime executive at CBS, actually, who is from Burlington, Wisconsin, and this was kind of a passion project of him, this movie called Just a Bit Outside that opens September 13th. So it's opening in Marcus Theaters in Milwaukee later this week. They've done a lot of press. It's out there. So I talked to Kelly and I talked to Gorman Thomas, who's obviously, as a member of that team, one of the people on the show. But anyway, I wanted to go back to here. This is what this team
does. I'm sure it's well. A great production. Great production. No doubt in my mind. Great production.
We all love.
For the love of God, we need something else in this town from baseball.
We love visiting the 1982 Brewers. This team, the 2024 Milwaukee Brewers, they hit well with runners in scoring position. Not this week, but in general, they're good at that. That's not a thing that really matters. People think it matters more than it does, but they're okay. They're good at that. They hit well with two outs. I believe they even hit well with two strikes, but certainly with two outs. This is not a team that gets its doors blown off ever. Today, we're recording this, of course, on Sunday. It's the second time since like August 13th, I think, that they've lost any game that was anything other than a one run game or extra innings. There have been two games since August 12th that they have lost that are deficits of more than one run or went to extras. So this, and they're both 3-run deficits. They were both safe situations. Wait, what was the score today? Was today a safe situation?
It was 4-1. Yeah, it was the least stressful save situation.
Yes, possible. I know. It was a bad game, but my point is, this is a team that hangs around. They win on the margins. They do the things that people like to talk about when you talk about gritty ball player teams or whatever. You can tell my enthusiasm for some of this stuff, like runners in scoring position. Give me a break. It's not a real thing. Keep telling yourself that it is, but it doesn't really matter. It's not a thing. But they do that stuff. So in essence, what I'm trying to say is I have to think there are a lot of teams that have this profile and are legitimate contenders to go deep into the postseason and do go deep in the postseason. But I also have no data to compare that to. I haven't looked at how teams do with runners in scoring position versus how they do in the postseason.
Yeah, that would be a great research project next week for the pod, please.
Let's do it. We'll
So here's what concerned me really about today's game, not just today's game. It was the fourth time this has happened. I wrote about this in the game story. This was the fourth instance in which toward the end of a game or directly at the end of a game, in some instances also in the beginning of the game, so like third inning on, as it was Sunday, the Brewers offense went absent. They were 0-21 to finish last Sunday's game in Cincinnati. They were 1-20 to finish Tuesday's game against the Cardinals. They had some really bad offense in Wednesday's game, but I didn't include any of those stretches. It was like bad, but not to this level. Friday's game, they had a 1-16 stretch allowing the Rockies basically to get back in that game and take that game. And then today, 0-23 to finish the game. I just haven't seen this from the offense this year. When they have a bad day, this is something I had in my head flying back from Cincinnati last Sunday. Oh, this is a really bad game from the Brewers today. They'll probably turn it around tomorrow. It's what they do. And sure enough, they did. They destroyed the Cardinals on Labor Day. Jackson Chourio hit a grand slam. And then they just they have not turned the page the last few days. And granted, it could just be a 1 week thing. Maybe it is. Their bad weeks are their bad games are bunched together, but there's a little bit of concern of like, what is going on that makes that happen? I'm just not used to seeing it. It's so unusual for this club that it's not a red flag, but it is the little, what do you call the wood, the stick of the flag. There's no flag attached to it, but I'm holding the stick and willing to browse for red flags on Amazon.com to attach to the stick. And then I'll be waving the red flag if this happens for another week.
I am.
Did that not work for you?
I'm once again not fully on board with the metaphor exactly, but I don't care.
It's not a red flag, but it almost is.
Here's the thing that I think
it's a stick.
It's a stick. Yeah, of course. Here, and you're buying red flags. Here's the thing that I guess I don't understand. And that is something that is within their control. And that's how they've managed their roster a little bit. I don't understand. I guess I kind of do on the surface why they may have sent down Brian Hudson. I know what their stated reason is. I don't buy it for a second. I think there were some veteran guys, namely Hobie Milner and Elvis Peguero, that they wanted to give maybe a last look to. And they sent down a guy with an option, that being Brian Hudson, who's one of the best relievers they've had all year, down to AAA. And they have a 10 multi, you know, double digit lead in the division. So like they can experiment and figure out what they want to do for the postseason. I'm in favor of that, but I thought that was a little weird. And then, and we've talked about this before. And again, the bullpen is not as big an issue right now as the offense, but Jacob Mizorowski is still at AAA. And I don't understand why. I know that he had a couple outings recently where he walked three dudes, and that's an issue. Talked about kind of the automated ball strike situation in AAA. It can be a little tricky. Sometimes things can come and go. That's fine. I don't know why they have him not on this roster. He is one of their best players, and there is not a lot of time left for him to acclimate to big league, you know, big league batters before the postseason. I'm left to believe that maybe they're not going to bring him up, and I don't get that, because you cannot convince me that he's not one of the best possible relievers for this postseason run. Instead, and we've talked about Hobie Milner before, we love him. He is not one of those people. He is having a really bad year, and he's had great years before. It's just not working out. He gave up a home run on Sunday. He gave up a hit in a key moment earlier in the week. He's not one of the best. He should not be on this postseason team. I don't think he's coming back next year. So what are they doing here? Why is he on the roster? Elvis Peguero, yeah, I could take him or leave him. He's a good reliever, but is he going to be on the postseason roster? I really don't think so. And so I'm curious what you think they're up to. I know each case is very specific. You know, maybe Jacob Mizorowski only needs a couple weeks to acclimate. So maybe they're just not there yet. They're feeling it out, whatever. But what's going on with this roster management? Because I'm a little befuddled what they're doing with this.
So there's nuance to all these things. And I think you did a good job of setting that up. And I hope that in my answer, we relay some of, if not all, the moving parts and the nuance of it all. To me, so you kind of asked about Mizorowski, but I think I'm going to start with Hudson, because that's where this whole operation and like the confusion that I have had in my head over the decisions began. I get that where he was at is not where the Brewers want him to be, with velocity, with the stuff, with recovery, all that. He needed some time off. But just like as a principal thing, I don't love when teams manipulate service time by sending guys down. And now this is not directly manipulating service time, but it depending on how many days he's down for, the Brewers could buy another year effectively of Brian Hudson. And at the very least, he's not in the big leagues right now making big league pay. And they're doing that. Like this, it was not performance based, at least in terms of results. Sure, the stuff to rest, but I generally don't like when teams send guys down so that they don't pitch as a way to preserve his arm in May and June, when we were talking about this then, when we brought this up as an issue then. Although, you know, maybe in the long run, this ends up being a good thing for him in terms of his, like, his health and his ability to bounce back this year. But off the top of your head, do you remember what this number of service days is, like, for you get bumped up to a full year. Usually teams manipulate it at the beginning of the year, like the Chris Bryant situation. You remember that? Where?
Yes, I do.
You're down for 21, 22 days. And you no longer get to, you basically, a team gets an extra year of club control. And I'm not saying that's the, what the Brewers are doing here. I think there are legitimately valid reasons in terms of like how he looks to try to buy him the rest. I just don't love that that's how the week started off. And then he was replaced by two pitchers who are not as good as him. Because at the end of the day, the Brewers are in the business of winning games and you're trying to get the two seed. And guess what? You lost three games this week, okay, the offense was terrible in these games, but at least a small part of it was these pitchers that you called up were back in the game in high leverage situations. Guess what? They were not good. So that's not great. You're three games back of the Phillies. Those are three big games. Now we move into
the
Mizorowski. Oh, good.
By the way, it's 172 days, I believe. For a typical, this typical season is 187 days. So 2 weeks down could make a difference. It could. And there's so much, service time is very elusive. There's a lot of, you know, there's Super 2 that comes in there and stuff. And I mean, if I'm being honest, I don't know if service time is the primary thing they're thinking about here, but it is artificial that he is not on the big league roster, because he is one of the best relievers, demonstrably one of the best relievers on this team. But he had an option and they could experiment with other things knowing that this is locked up. And that's still iffy. Yeah, I don't love it. But anyway, okay, go to Mizorowski. Right.
I don't love it for multiple reasons. I also don't love the message it sends to the clubhouse. I think that might be the biggest thing here. What message does that send? That this guy who's been your best reliever this year, look at the numbers. He has been the best reliever on this team. Most consistent, most reliable. Any role you ask him to. He's not the one putting him, like, overusing himself. They're the ones overusing him. That's why you didn't manage his innings back on the front end. And now look, I don't love that message. That might not be a big thing. It might be something. I don't know. All I know is the message that was sent when Jesse Winker was on the playoff roster last year was not good to guys like Garrett Mitchell and, well, honestly, the rest of the clubhouse. Not a good message there. I do think that stuff matters. How much it matters, I'm not entirely sure, but I don't love that. On the other hand, you do understand, like, why they want to do right by Hobie Milner. He's a guy who's been here. He's a guy they like. He's a well-liked, hardworking guy.
Of course.
And give him another chance instead of flat-out DFAing him. But it was pretty clear from the jump that he's not one of the best 28. Best 26, not 28. Back to 26 for the playoffs. And I think that now we can get to the Mizorowski part of it.
Hmm.
I don't know if Jacob Mizorowski is one of this team's best 26.
Oh, you don't? You think that's up for debate?
I think he is. But I think he has earned the right, and with the way that the roster is currently constructed, and there are these bullpen spots in flux, and two of them opened up this past week, one by the Brewers' own doing of sending Brian Hudson down, I do think he has deserved that right, or he has earned that right. And also, it's in the best Brewers' best interest to see if that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
Who in this bullpen has that stuff, that ability? Devin Williams in a different way. Aaron Ashby in a different way. I don't know if it would work out for Mizorowski. I can't say he would come up here and I guarantee he would throw strikes. But I can tell you this. At AAA right now, when he is commanding the ball, which is most outings, he did have a shaky command outing this week, his first one and since his first outing, basically, where he didn't have it. When he's in the zone, he's untouchable. These guys at AAA look like single-A hitters against him. Big league hitters are better. They can do damage. But they're not. Like, the game doesn't change that significantly where that stuff suddenly no longer plays. And I think you just want to see it, right? You want to see if that can be a guy who helps you down the road. Now, does he work his way into a super trusted high-leverage role at this point? Who knows? Maybe not. They do seem to have a good thing going on with Ashby and McGill and Devin and Koenig and Hall and Piamps. I would like to see it. And to me, there's a significant chance of not only Mizorowski being one of your best 26 or one of your best 28. Right now, he's one of your best 28 over some of the guys at the back of the bullpen. But for the playoff roster, there's a good chance of him being one of your best 12, or 14. Maybe it doesn't work out. Maybe he can't find the strike zone. That's okay. Try it again next year. It just feels like no harm, no foul when you called up two guys this week who are not going to factor into your playoff roster at all. And I could have told you that when you called them up.
Precisely. And you mentioned Aaron Ashby, whose revelation continues to be amazing, and DL Hall, who looks really good. I think they got enough lefties, man. I mean, between those guys and Brian Hudson, who's Hobie going to get out in the playoffs? Like, what role is he going to serve? I mean, he's not a...
It was nice to do the right thing for him and give him
a course.
Shot.
And we love him. He's
but also
he's a
this
phenomenal
love,
dude.
Love Hobie. Great guy. Has been a great pitcher for this team. Unfortunately, this year, he doesn't have it at that level. And like, it's a business. That's how this works. His team's in first place. It's unfortunate. It stinks. Like I said, I love Hobie, but that seems to be the reality right now.
Yeah. Bryce Wilson went on the injured list earlier this week, which didn't necessarily surprise me. I was shocked though, that it was Figuero and Milner who were the guys that came back. You know, Nick Mears is still sitting out there. He's on the injured list. Is he going to, I mean, I would have said, I don't think Hobie's coming
Paredes,
back.
Maybe still right. Factors into this. Yeah. Like there's
ZRA is well below two this year.
I think I would have rather have seen Kevin Hergett, in some of these moves to see what's there. Than some of the other guys. Like we were chatting during these games, and when Higuero came into that game and it went sideways fast, we were both the least surprised people as possible. And the same thing when they went to Milner in Wednesday's game, which was baffling decision. I don't really
truly know. Of the weird moves this year, that is the weirdest. I think it's number one of the strange things Pat Murphy's bullpen management has done this year.
Yeah, I think there was a way where they just like had to pitch someone like that, but bring Piamps out to start that inning, and then after four pitches being like, yeah, he's been overworked a lot recently, so they just
then don't throw him. He threw four pitches. That's not a lot.
They just did not want Arenado to beat them, and instead, well,
which is stupid because Arenado's not that good. Not this year.
Piamps has been good against right. I mean, not just good, like elite against righties. The OPS is in the fours, starts in the fours. So, yeah, I was scratching my head about that one, and now I've discussed it, and now we can cross it off the list. Good.
Yeah.
Never speak of it again.
We were thinking a lot about it. Piguero coming in an extra.
Do you have anything positive you'd like to speak about now that we're 25 minutes into this and have bashed everything?
I thought Piguero coming into that game was fine. Because there was extras and they were running out of bodies.
Oh, no. Yeah, no. The Piguero spot was totally fine.
Yeah.
They had so many games in a row. No off days. Someone had to pitch. Yeah. No, that spot was fine for him.
Okay. Here's positive. Frankie Montas looked amazing again this week. Amazing might be too strong, but he was really good. Tobias Myers looked amazing. Struck out 11 dudes in six innings. The team struck out 16 batters on Saturday in a win against Colorado. I don't know who the playoff rotation is. Like, I think I do, and I think there are no changes since we last discussed, but I truly don't know the answer. I mean, I think it's obviously Freddy Peralta game one, and I think Colin Ray is still game two, but Colin Ray has struggled a little bit. I'm not sure right now I would trust Colin Ray to get the ball in game two, but Frankie Montas might be moving up those power rankings.
Frankie Montas. Yeah, no, we owe an apology to the Frankie Montas.
We were wrong. He's really
now,
good.
He did lose to the Rockies. Let us begin with that.
He did serve up a very bad gopher ball, but three runs should not cost you a game.
I think his stuff and the way he's pitched has generally been solidly above average since coming to Milwaukee. He's pitched at a level that I wasn't sure he was going to have. Like, I don't even know what his ERA is since he's been here. But, like, the pure process of the outings has been solid. I still don't feel great giving him the ball in game two, but it does give you another option if you're not into the Colin Ray thing in a game two situation. Freddie's going to get the ball game one. We just all need to come to grips with that. We'll see how that goes. Could be good, could be bad, could be great, could be most frustrating thing you've ever seen since Corbin. Well, actually, not the most frustrating thing you've ever seen, because we did see Corbin Burnes give up, four gopher balls to the Diamondbacks just last year. Which, by the way, I'm so excited to watch the Orioles. I'm like so captivated by that team this postseason. Maybe it's just because they have Corbin, and I'm really curious to see what he does in the playoffs right before he's about to get a huge payday. But that team's super interesting to me. Anyway, I don't know who, like, they don't have a number two. Tobias Myers pitched the game of his life on Saturday night, yet I still am probably not giving him the ball game two.
I know.
Maybe not even over Frankie Montas. But this is not to get back to the Mizorowski thing, but to get back to the Mizorowski thing, what if he comes up, he's reliable, he commands the ball. Suddenly, game two and game three of a wild card series, because it feels like that's where the Brewers are going right now, can look a whole lot different. Frankie Montas doesn't have to face the lineup the third time, because guess what? He had a no-hitter through the first two times against the Rockies. It was the third time. Like, when a lot of this is not a rotation that fares well the third time. That's true of anyone in baseball, but especially true of this team. Freddie Peralta really struggles the third time. Frankie Montas has had issues the third time. Tobias Myers' third time through numbers, generally not good. Don't know what Colin Ray's are. I would actually guess he's probably fine relative to the rest third time through, but that is there could be many pathways forward with the shape of this pitching staff. DL Hall could factor into it huge. Aaron Ashby, all these guys.
Yeah. I think the surprising thing we saw from Colin Ray this week was just walking two runs in back to back in what became a one run game and an extra inning game. That's unusual. Add that to the list of unusual things that you've seen this week, including an offense that just hasn't responded the way that they have at points this year. Freddie Peralta, I think that's one of the big frustrations with him, is that he loses the zone and he ends up walking or getting way behind in counts. And sometimes he pulls out of it. A lot of times he pulls out of it, but he puts himself in such rough shape that it only takes, you know, one reasonably good swing to put some damage on the board. And that's what happened on Sunday, right? I mean, in this case, it was Hobie Milner who served up the home run, but it was right. But it was Peralta who put everybody on base. So, another playoff question, which is a little bigger picture and not necessarily looking at this team specifically, but there's a pretty good race for that last wild card spot. The New York Mets are white hot. Now, they did just lose on Sunday for the first time in 10 games, but they have caught the Atlanta Braves. And right now, I believe, have the tiebreaker over the Atlanta Braves for that final spot. If the season ended today, it would be the New York Mets coming to Milwaukee, and not only coming to Milwaukee for the playoffs, but also in Milwaukee for the last three games of the regular season, which is interesting. David Stearns, a six-day residency back in Milwaukee. That could be an interesting scenario. I'd be curious how you see those matchups. If there's one team, like, Atlanta's got elite pitching, they've got Chris Sale, who's probably going to win the Cy Young Award, and I could see that being a tougher short series matchup than the Mets. The Brewers are 3-0 against the Mets this year. They've had some success. I don't know though if you want the Mets being in Milwaukee for 3 days and then get, you know, like, you completely lose that, like, you don't completely lose your home field advantage, which, by the way, the Brewers are just a couple games worse on the road than they are at home. It's not like that really matters to this team, but I don't know. That's a weird dynamic. So give me your thoughts on that race, and if there's one that you think is better for the Brewers over the other.
So we were talking about this not too long ago, covering one of the games, and there was someone who said they would want no part of the Braves, because then you've got Sale and you've got Fried, right?
Yeah.
Assuming it Fried lines up that way.
Just okay.
Okay. Although I'm not sure it's going to line up that way necessarily with the way these teams are going to have to maybe push to the finish line. Like, seeding, it's not just seeding that's going to matter for these teams, but like, you need, the Brewers are going to want this thing to be as close as possible down to the finish line. So it's not a situation like last year where the Diamondbacks, oh, look, they can line their guys up basically for the most part. I see the way the Braves are playing right now, and that is not a team that is daunting, to use a Pat Murphy word, in really any way. I mean, Sale's gonna win Cy Young probably, and they've got some big names. Ozuna, is Albies gonna be back, question mark
still,
either I'm way sure. Like, Gio Urshela is their third baseman.
That's not great.
It's not a great unit right now. Sean Murphy's not hitting well. Orlando Arcia is not playing great. This is not the Braves team of last year or the year before or the year before. I know it's Sale and I know it's Fried, but if you can avoid somehow lining those guys up perfectly, even if you can't, like, that seems like a unit you would much rather play than the Mets, especially with the way the Mets are playing. And also, maybe the Diamondbacks are in this mix too. I believe they're a game ahead of the Mets coming into the day. Maybe they bumped that lead up a little bit or whatever.
They played on Sunday Night Baseball here, so I think that game's going on as we're speaking.
I don't think anyone with the Brewers wants to play that game again. And with the way that offense is going, understandable. I think the Braves, to me, partially off vibes, is the team you don't want to play. Oh, but the Mets could throw a billion lefties at you. You know how that would go for the Brewers. Hey, here's Quintana. Oh, you like that? Here's David Peterson. Oh, we're going to game three? Sean Manaea. Good luck.
Well, Manaea is legitimately scary. I would much rather think the Brewers would want to see those other two guys over Chris Sale, for example.
That's true, but it's still a lefty is a lefty. See what Kyle Freeland did to these boys today?
Ugh. It is so frustrating.
A lefty is a lefty. They crushed Chris Sale, too.
Are other teams bad at lefties, or is it just the Milwaukee Brewers baseball team? Because
I don't
this
know.
Is every year. Better, this has been every year since we've been adults.
The numbers say they've been better against lefties this year, but also they're 18-22 in games started by a lefty. So that's pretty bad for a team that is 20 games over 500 generally. I'm sure other teams do struggle against lefties, but the Brewers have two curses. One, they could put prime Barry Bonds at first base and he would carry a 92 OPS plus.
That's true. Yes.
Number two, if it's coming from the left side, I was going to make a political joke there, but this is an anti-political podcast. Never mind.
That's true.
They're not going to hit it if it's from the left side.
Perhaps Rhys Hoskins can solve both of these problems because he does clearly have some history with the Mets. Maybe he does catch fire in the postseason. It has been a rough year for that man. And maybe in the postseason, he's awesome. He's crushing lefties, crushing the Mets lefties. But you are absolutely right. The Diamondbacks are a game ahead of these teams. The Padres are two games ahead of these teams. To think that the wild card is settled in any way, shape, or form is preposterous. Both Arizona and San Diego went on absolute heaters through August. They were white hot. They could not be stopped. You know, that's not where they are right now. Now they're, you know, back to earth a little bit. So maybe that was the best of them. And maybe there's still a lot of movement to go. So obviously there's a lot of movement to go. Although I do think the Brewers are going to win this division and still win it pretty handily. Their magic number is 10. Theoretically, Kurt Hoge, theoretically, they could clinch this week before we have another podcast. Now, of course, that's not going to happen, but it could happen. So we've entered the mathematical possibility territory. West Coast, man. That's just probably not the place you want to be when you are struggling, like the Brewers did on this homestand. Let's go out west and see the Diamondbacks and the Giants.
Forget the Brewers. I'm in the media. What does that start with?
Me.
Shout out Grant Bills. It's going to be over 100 all 3 days in Arizona next weekend.
Gross.
Who decided that was a good idea? It's okay, though. I do like Phoenix, so I'll make the most of it. And that way, I will not be still here and tempted to drop $150 on a Wisconsin-Alabama ticket. Or, you know, prices might dip down a little bit this week because the Badgers are kind of poo-poo.
Yeah.
So
tremendously bad weekend for Wisconsin sports.
I thought you were going to say tremendously poo-poo.
Tremendously poo-poo. No, I won't go that far.
Sounds like conversations we're having with Emma right now.
They are 2-0. Tremendously poo-poo is part of your conversation with Emma. They are 2-0, the Badgers. They are undefeated.
That's they right. Are undefeated. They sure are. But the prices are going to go down for this week's game. Probably, maybe not, because they're not. Maybe they dipped a little bit. I'm saying I would, if I was here and not in Arizona, I would talk myself into buying one. Supporting ye old alma mater and then trying to forget about the game ever happening at Lucky's 13-13 after the game.
$150 ain't going to get you in that door at Camp Randall Stadium. That's all I'm telling you right now. Of course, that'll be an exciting game. I'll be there. No, I mean, I can't say in the moments leading up to that game, you know, maybe there's like a panic market that's probably in that range, but not right now. We'll see though. We'll see the Badgers in Alabama. I'll be at that game. That'll be interesting.
Ooh,
maybe
100. Well, oh, that's not including fees. 141 is the get in price plus fees right now.
Yeah, that's what I'm. Yes. So actually, that's a little closer than I thought it would be. I was thinking with fees.
Certainly, a bunch of my college buddies went to the Ohio State game. We had a bit of a reunion last year. We had tailgate, and then they all went to the game. They're like, "You don't want to come?" And I'm like, "No, I don't want to spend $150 to sit in the upper deck to watch the batters inevitably get smoked by four touchdowns." No, they played better than that, but I still didn't say spend the money.
You're very prudent, Kurt Hoge. It would have been tremendously poo-poo to waste such money. Let's go to some of the more granular details from the week. Here we go. It is our weekly segment. Three up, three down. Kurt, let's start positive. Jackson Churio just like straight up called a grand slam on Monday before anyone was on base. I love that. According to Willie Adames and Freddie Peralta, who gave a very vibes forward interview after this game, after a very nice crowded Labor Day win over the Cardinals, 9-3, three home runs. It was pretty electric in there. They said that Jackson Churio came up and told them that he was going to hit a grand slam. The second that he's hit this year, there was no one on base at the time, but sure enough, they loaded up those bases. This is the same game where Willie Adames hit another three-run homer to tie Ken Griffey Jr.'s MLB record, which we'll probably talk about. And then Jackson Churio delivers on the home run, hits another Titanic blast. He is one away from being the first rookie at age 20, first anyone at age 20, to go 20-20 in Major League Baseball. It is about to happen. And it's very exciting, Kurt. Very, very exciting stuff.
Okay, so you touched on Willie's three-run home run. Are we being stupid? Is this dumb? Is this stupid? Is the three-run home run record stupid?
I would say no, it is not stupid. Maybe that's wrong. Trivial. Silly? It is random. Okay. Trivial. Silly is too strong. I mean, three-run homers are great.
Are we making too much of this? Is this really a thing?
To me, it is the same as saying the Brewers are undefeated on Sundays. You know, like let's say they were still undefeated on Sundays. That'd be amazing. But also trivial.
I'm in between on this. Once again, struggling to come up with a real side to take on this, but I feel like having some fun with the fact that Willie Adames is always hitting three-run homers, fun. But you can take it too far. You can try to make it a real thing, and it's kind of just not.
Where I think they maybe took it too far? Ken Griffey Jr. giving a like records are made to be broken speech. It's cool, it's neat, but like, come on, guys, it's a random series of events that the homers happen to have two runners on base, like exactly two runners. That's weird that we're like,
they should know. Actually, that needs to become, I agree with you, but now that I'm thinking about it, that needs to become common practice. Who has the franchise stolen base record? Scott Pesednik?
Maybe Tommy Harper.
Okay, either way, not even either of those guys. Say you surpass Jonathan VR for like third all time in steals in a single season in franchise history.
Jonathan VR.
Third place records are meant to be broken. It's yours, Bryce Strang. That's what I want.
That's the game. That's incredible stuff. That's so wild.
Danny Kolb for saves in a year. I want that video.
That would be very special. Derek Turnbow. You can get all the former Brewers closers to give a speech on saves in a year. So John Axford chimes in, Derek Turnbow, Dan Kolb, Trevor Hoffman shows up for some reason. Who else? We have a lot of possibilities. Mike Fetters gives a little speech.
It's kind of got to be obscure records. So like franchise holds record. Kurt Luskanic maybe has it.
I think that's probably right. That's a random name. So I was going to say Tommy Harper has the record. He's the first All-Star, one of the original Brewers in 1970, and he technically does. But that was the 1969 season, when they were the Seattle Pilots. So he had 73 stolen bases. Scotty Pods had 70 in 2004. So Tommy Harper is technically the answer, but it's also not Brewers exactly, for what it's worth. The more you know.
Good to know. Okay, you're on to the next one while I researched a very fun fact to see if I can find it about franchise holds.
Okay, I love that. Isaac Collins got his first hit. He was promoted to the big league roster on Sunday. Brewer Hicklin back out. Brewer Hicklin was the guy who was added to the roster when rosters expanded at the beginning of September. He lasted a week. He still doesn't have his first major league hit. He's working on it. Unfortunately, he also got thrown out at third for the last out of a game in a one-run game. That's a major, major oopsie. I don't know if that necessarily played into the decision, but Isaac Collins gets called up on Sunday. He gets a hit in his first at-bat with the Brewers. He then steals the base, which is just what you do if you're a member of the Milwaukee Brewers. So that was kind of a cool moment. And unfortunately, as we talked about, the offense dried up immediately after that, 23 in a row to close the game. But that was kind of a that was kind of a cool moment. You posted something, Kurt. I know I don't want to interrupt you while you're like frantically researching holds records, which is certainly what people tune into this podcast for. You posted something that threw me off. That Isaac Collins, maybe high school football teammates with Brad Davison. Is that what you're trying to tell me? Because yes! I can't believe that.
They shared a backfield together. Brad was the quarterback and Isaac. I'm not sure what Isaac Collins played. Probably running back given his stature.
He led the team in rushing. He was the rushing leader.
Yeah, no, also given the fact that he was a rushing leader, he almost certainly played running back. Great point. Yeah, Maple Grove High School in Minnesota.
What an incredible find. I mean,
as soon as they flashed his bio, I knew he was from Maple Grove. I mean, like, I have some connections to there. So that was like very deep in the back of my brain from previous Isaac Collins baseball referencing. But when they put that up on the scoreboard today, I go, you know what? He's about probably the same age as Brad Davison. There's no way they played football together. Oh, sure enough. I wonder if they played basketball together too. He seems like an athletic little fellow.
For sure. For sure. So I could see him being Davidson's backup, like the backup point guard. You could see that, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. Oh, yeah. He'll give you 94 feet of misery as a defender, no doubt. Oh, could you imagine trying to score on that duo? Brad Davison taking charges and Isaac Collins swiping the ball away. Wow, Maple Grove must have had, but they must have been living the life from 2014 to 2017.
What a tremendous find. To
also, another find on there. Do you know who Evan Hull is?
It does ring a bell. I don't know. Help me out.
He was a running back at Northwestern. He was on the Colts for a little bit. Might still be on the Colts.
He was on the
Colts, actually. He was also not on that team, but I think he was on the team the next year. So Maple Grove was really thriving for a few years.
Incredible.
Not unusual for Maple Grove. Affluent.
What an incredible detail. All right, that is my number two. Are you prepared with number two, or do you want me to go for three?
I've gotten prepared with number two. I've got a fact for you. Jeremy Jeffress.
Holds
owns leader. The franchise holds record. Now, also, I don't know how far back this goes. Probably not very far, I'm guessing, considering how, like, the oldest name I'm seeing on this franchise record, all-time record list is, like, Luis Vizcaíno. So probably not very far back. But nevertheless,
well, keep in mind, we didn't pitch like this in 1980s. Like, there was nobody coming in for a three, you know, a one-inning stint.
The Brewers were never winning. So Jeremy Jeffress has 63. Will Smith has 62. Devin has 60. I'm going to bring this up to him and tell him he's four holds shy of the franchise record and see if he'll give up some save opportunities. Stay tuned to see how that goes. Brad Boxberger, Brian Schaus. K-Rod, Carlos Villanueva, Luis Vizcaíno, Cam Lowe, and then Yoel Piamps. Rounds out the top 10.
It's amazing that K-Rod is in there.
Yeah, that is kind of remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, he was here closing a lot, not the year they brought him in, but primarily after that. That's interesting.
Yeah, maybe it's not to be trusted. Who knows? But it seems like it is. Anyway, number two, we talked about it briefly. Tobias Myers, 11 strikeouts. Now, so the good. Road Rockies are a different animal. Like, they're White Sox level bad on offense. Yeah. Tobias Myers absolutely carved them up. The fastball got, I think, 10 whiffs on 16 swings. Insane. We talked up that pitch early on, and it's got the, you know, wonderful metrics and hasn't quite played up to the swing and miss maybe that we thought it was going to, possibly because the angle it's coming in is a little steep with his arm being up here and whatnot. But what a call. I was just thinking about this earlier today, JR. How many things have we gotten wrong?
Oh, a lot. So many.
But we did one time say Tobias Myers' name.
We did better than that for us.
What did we do?
We were
that
right
was about it. About Tobias. Okay, that's fair.
I'm trying to think. There has to be something else that we got right. No, we were wrong. We were wrong.
Yoho, maybe? Early Craig Yoho adopters.
If anyone would let us try the Craig Yoho thing, we would know we're right then, but we haven't even had an opportunity.
That's true.
I'll look it up next week. I can make a list of things that we were right about. It might be a really short list, but I'm confident we had more things.
We need to get. We need to dip our toes into the international prospect market. Which, by the way, I think you know this. I don't know if you know this though. I have like a list of like 20 names that the Brewers are expected to sign this next year. Maybe we'll drop that on a podcast or the internet sometime soon. That's just stewing in my Google Docs right now, waiting to be dropped. Maybe we can be right about some of those people if we just say their names early. Who knows? Jesus Mate.
Can I be honest? I'm not even remote, not like even interested in those names because there's so many and they're all so young. And it's like just buying grocery store and saying, give me 10 lottery tickets.
No, but within 7 months of the Brewers signing these cats this year, Jesus Mate is on top 100 lists.
I hear what you're saying. That lottery ticket got them $1,000. It's definitely great. You should cash that in for more lottery tickets. But I am interested in this group though, because there's one name that you've alluded me to that I'm really interested in. So we'll
stash that along for a rainy day.
Let's go.
Good radio.
My number three, kind of a weird moment in one of these Cardinals losses where the Brewers, you know, they had given up a lead in extras. Ryan Helsley had checked in. The Cardinals were going to win, and there were two outs, two strikes. You know, the ghost runner was still on second or third. I don't even know, but the Brewers were down a run. Willie Adames hit a ball, a double it ended up being, but it was nearly caught by Michael Ciani and then kind of dropped. And it was a perfect NFL opening week moment of completing the process of the catch. And whether or not it was a catch, the review, like the review took a long time. It was like, I think it's a catch, but legitimately don't know for sure because of how long he had it. And, you know, he didn't transfer it. It just kind of squirted out of his glove after he had dove for it, smothered it, and it looked like a catch, but then it was gone. It was out of his glove. So ruled a double. Willie Adames ties the game. It could have been an incredible moment. Of course, in the next half inning, it went very wrong. The Cardinals scored a bunch of runs. The Brewers couldn't answer. So they lose the game, but a clutch moment for Willie Adames. Perish the thought. The guy is just nothing but clutch moments this season. He's been tremendous. So that was kind of a weird one. A fun one, I guess, for the moment, even though the Brewers ended up going on losing that game.
I thought in football, it would be a catch. People told me I was wrong to think that. But I thought it would be a catch.
Like, the bar's really high in football. Like, you have to basically catch it, get up, deliver it to someone in the audience, and then it's a catch. That's pretty much how it has to go.
But like, if football has, and maybe this is a different play because this is surviving the ground, but football has the timing element to it too, right? Where you catch it two steps and then a timing element or a football move.
Yes.
He was making the football. He had the ball for a while. Like he caught it and then he slid all the way forward till his momentum stopped and then started turning on his back. And it wasn't like immediately as he turned that he lost the ball. He was like kind of contorting his wrist to like pull his glove up and show the ump. And then he lost the ball. Yeah. In baseball, it's not a catch. Although I kind of felt like it should have been a catch.
I kind of did too. It
felt like a catch at my core. Because if that happened to my team in football, the guy makes a diving catch. He survives the ground. He slides all the way to his stop. And then as he's rolling over to lift the ball and show the ref, he drops it. Oh, God, I just described Jazz Peavy's would-be catch in 2015 against Northwestern. Excuse me, this podcast is now over. I must go shower.
Jazz caught it. We all know he caught it. Yeah, I think that would have been a good time to just explain the rule, actually, in the aftermath of that game. But it ended up being moot. It didn't matter. Ciani is actually the guy who got the big hit that kind of created that separation, made it a three-run game going into the bottom half of whatever that was, the 12th. That was on Tuesday night. So yeah, and it ended well for the Cardinals. But it would have been quite the story if his like ground can't cause the fumble moment turned into the moment that got the Brewers a chance to win the game. Do you have one more? Or are we out? Are we done with three up, three down?
I've got one more. I mean, we did basically hit on everything already, sort of organically in this. The Brewers did have a lot of bad offense this week. very little clutch hitting, but they did get one clutch hit. Well, besides Willie's hit, they did get another clutch hit. Remember Eric Haas? He's on the team, JR?
Yes, this team has three catchers. Sometimes I forget.
One of whom has a name, Eric Haas. Game-tying homer that he almost hit out of the stadium.
Yeah.
In the eighth inning of Wednesday's ultimate 3-2 loss. That was the game where Hyams began the extra inning, and then they went to Hobie Milner, and Logan Baker decided and made that a bad decision. But Eric Haas led off the inning with a homer against a lefty, Jojo Romero, I believe. And, you know, Eric Haas has not played a lot. And it's got me thinking, who's got it better than an MLB player who never plays?
Mm, that's a good point. It's the highest money-making sport. It's not very, you know, it's pretty easy to just kind of come
in. He's got it good right now. Catch once a week. That's about it. Be a good clubhouse guy. So shout out to Eric Haas. He's got it good right now.
I'm pretty sure he would tell you, I don't know for sure that he would tell you this, but I feel strongly that he would say, I cannot hit it harder or farther than I hit that baseball, because it felt like that took out every ounce that you would expect his bat to have to just truck that thing. Incredible bomb. I still think he's their best defensive catcher. I mean, I don't even think that's controversial. So I wonder if there's a greater place for him somehow in the late innings of this the postseason. You know, I said on the last podcast that we had that maybe we should put a pin in the idea of William Contreras just calling fastball after fastball after fastball and how that seems to be impacting some pitchers' pitch selection. I don't know if I have more data to like really get into that right now, but I like Eric Haas behind the plate. I think the Brewers are at their best when he's calling the game. It's just you can't take William Contreras' bat out, and Gary Sanchez has been pretty reliable too offensively, so I don't know. And they're not terrible catchers, so you're not like losing something per se. All right, what else? What else did we not talk about on 3 Up, 3 Down this week? You know, we talked about Hobie Milner quite a bit. I think if I had to guess this week, there'll probably be some resolution on that front. I don't know if it means Mizorowski or not, but I have to think that there's probably some changes coming as they start to tweak this roster ready for the postseason. Blake Perkins had a really nice relay throw to Willie Adames at shortstop on Sunday. And then they got Ezekiel Tovar streaking for third. I have no idea how they got him. The ball was hit to the warning track. He was just trying to tag up from second to third. He would have been at third with one out. So another nice defensive play. Mentioned Brewer Hicklin making the final out at third base. That was a tough scene. He was a pinch runner on that play. Devin Williams had one of the most dominating innings I have ever seen from a Brewers reliever. And Trevor McGill had an inning like this earlier, so I know that they've been like this, but 11 pitches, 3 strikeouts on Saturday to absolutely eviscerate any hope that the Colorado Rockies had. That was Devin Williams. I mean, he has probably not been what you'd think of as peak Devin Williams this season since coming back from that back injury, but holy Moses, was he good. Oh, and lastly, we got into some crowd discourse with Pat Murphy talking about how the team needs the crowd to be really at its best. The energy was really good on Labor Day. We know, sellout crowd, et cetera, et cetera. Very electric. And he hadn't seen it since. Now, part of that problem is that, you know, they played a game on Friday started it at 5 o'clock on a Friday because the Packers were playing at 7. So they, you know, wanted to get out of the way a little bit. Still nobody came to that game. So it's a little tough once Packer season starts to keep the energy flowing. We'll see. I always get a little annoyed with crowd discourse. That's not the reason you can't hit a little tiny sphere coming 95 miles an hour with break at you. But that's what it is. All right, let's go back in time a little bit. It is our weekly segment of Brewers History. Here it is. Remember when. So, Kurt, I mentioned that I've got this 1982 interview. I know people are going to be really excited. Talking about this Just a Bit Outside documentary that profiles the 1982 Milwaukee Brewers and their relationship with Milwaukee. I wanted to find something from the 82 season that I thought was kind of relevant. This is probably not a moment per se, but just a look at this team. They, kind of interestingly to me, only had one walk-off win all season in 1982. And they had 10, I think, or might even be more, walk-off losses during the season. They were 5-14 in extra innings. This is the 1982 team that won 95 games and went to the World Series. 5-14 in extra inning games. I looked specifically at their early September. It was pretty tight. I think people remember that they were tied on the last day of the season because Baltimore beat them 3 straight games, and then they had to win the final game of the season, which they did with Don Sutton on the mound, to get into the playoffs in the first place. But, you know, they were they weren't crushing at any point in September, you know, like it was, the lead was two games mostly, I would say, maybe up to three or four. They had a stretch right around this time of year that was really, really frustrating, very similar to the 2024 Brewers. They took a 4-2 loss on September 2nd when Von Hayes had a three-run homer with two outs in the ninth to, or I think it was only one out in the ninth, but still to, this was against Don Sutton, who pitched the whole game. So they were going to win 2-1, and then they lost 4-2. September 6th, they lose to Detroit in extras. 4 days later, they had allowed three runs in the eighth. They got two back, and then they gave up a run in the 10th. Lou Whitaker, by the way, stole home in that rally. That's awesome. September 9th, 3 days after that, the Yankees won in the 10th, 5-4. Jerry Mumphrey off Pete Ladd. Pete Ladd, by the way, who took the place of Raleigh Fingers in the postseason and delivered only four innings, but they were four very good innings, with the exception of one walked-in run that most people agree was a bad call by the umpire. Should have been a strikeout. Even the batter thought it was a strikeout. He was not great in the regular season when he took Raleigh Fingers' place in September. He had a FIP of 5.99. So he was very young, ended up having a really big role in the playoffs. But this is one of those like random heroes of the playoff situation because he really struggled down the stretch. September 12th. So 3 days after that loss, they lost an 8-2 lead and fell 9-8. They were up 8-2. Three-run eighth, one run allowed in the ninth. Greg Nettles, Bobby Ramos homering for the Yankees. Walk-off single by Roy Smalley. The next day, it's a 4-3 loss to Detroit. Two runs in the 11th, you know, to the Tigers after the Brewers had scored in the top of the 10th. So they took the lead, and then they lost. Gorman Thomas homered, but so did Lance Parrish with a runner on. Off Pete Ladd. Bummer. 18 innings for Pete Ladd. He allowed five home runs, six walks, 16 hits. Not what you want. Only a 4 ERA, but... So yeah, that's it. Just a little look at the 1982 team. A reminder, perhaps, that the best teams in Brewers history even have had stretches where it's very frustrating and September comes around and they get tight and things get a little weird and haywire, but they still maybe have a good postseason run in them, like the 1982 team. All right, before we get to that interview, though, we have one more thing that we have to do, as we do every week on this podcast, and that is Kurt's Take of the Week. Here it is, Kurt Blanche.
I just love hearing about the 1982 Brewers.
I know you do. I know you do. You know, I tried to ask.
Maybe it's because I wasn't alive then. Maybe that's it.
I was a babe. I don't have
that sentimental attachment that everybody in Milwaukee, Ozaukee, Waukesha, Washington, Kenosha, Racine, Walworth counties have for that team. Maybe I'm missing it. Maybe I'm missing out. That's just too bad. I'm going to have that's the cross I'm going to have to bear. That's okay.
I kind of tried to ask what makes this documentary different because we have heard so much about it. I mean, I'm more interested in it. I got interested in it during COVID when there was no baseball and they were showing some of those games on Bally Sports or whatever, Fox Sports Net or whatever it was at the time. So I got into it a little bit then, but we've heard a lot about it. We've heard
Look,
so
I'm a
much.
Sucker. I'm a sucker for baseball history and baseball content though. So I'm going to be all over it.
Well, watch it.
It's just the process of the 1982 Brewers. I can't do it anymore. I can't do it anymore. They didn't even win. They didn't win the whole thing. Okay. Anyway, where were we? Oh, yeah. It's my turn to speak. JR, we had a softball game this week. The Pud Galvin Cup. Big, 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 big sporting event. Big, big display of athleticism on both sides. No more than on the media side, of course. For those of you who don't know, and thank God that you don't. That's good for you. There's a somewhat annual softball game between Brewers employees and members of the local media that cover the team. Play at Hellfire Field. A couple games. The winner gets the Pud Galvin Cup. This year, JR, the media won. The media does not win often, but this year the media won. Shout out David Goh, CBS 58 intern, student at UWM. Won the home run derby swing off. Although I will say we did win a game. We did win one game that got us to the swing off. Dom Catronio, go ahead, three run homer in the bottom of the sixth. That was pretty clutch.
Let's not gloss over the contributions of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel team. Todd Rosiak hit not one, but two home runs. One of them at least, that was a three run homer. So that's a Willie Adames special. And then you also, Kurt Hoge, homered in your first at bat as well. This was a big moment for the Milwaukee Journal.
It was great. It was a great way to start. It was mostly downhill from there, except for when we did single in front of Adames, go ahead, homer. So
that was just key.
You know, pass the baton, let someone else carry the water. You know, that's how we operate, undaunted. now I have a This is kind of lame, but
before you move on,
go ahead.
This is one of the greatest moments of our lives, just to be clear.
Oh, well, no doubt. No doubt that this specific moment was pretty high up there. But in the aftermath of it, I've been thinking, like, softball doesn't do it for me. I know a lot of people play it, and it's, you know, kind of an excuse probably for people to get together and have some beverages on nights. And that sounds fun. I love camaraderie. I love friendship. I love athletics. But, like, something about it, maybe it was the format of this game. We had like 17 players. Just doesn't do it for me. I played baseball. I love baseball. But I don't have an itch. I thought this was going to like create an itch in me to like go hit baseballs or hit softballs. But no, I just don't have it. This isn't related to the Brewers or anything. It's not my spiciest spice. It's like a 4 out of 10 when you go to the Thai restaurant and they ask you how much spice on your... No, it's probably like a 2 for most people, actually, because 4 for me would be nothing. I love spice. Softball doesn't do it for me. I know a lot of people love it. That's cool. It can be your thing. I just wasn't having it.
Yeah.
The Pud Galvin Cup, though, of course. Winning the Pud Galvin Cup. Huge. Huge event.
Absolutely. Life-changing.
But that was enough for me. I was like, okay, I had my 3 slices of pizza. I'm going to go home now.
All right. I still think softball's pretty cool. I don't love it as much as I used to because I've gotten old and I'm not as good as I was. I wasn't even really good to begin with, of course, but now I'm just extraordinarily bad. What was tremendously poo-poo? Is that the terminology, I believe? So
that's right.
That's what I am now. And in many facets of life, but yeah, I can't hit home runs or anything. And I am maybe 50-50 if a ball's screaming at me that I'm actually going to make the play. So I think that that has discouraged me from continuing my softball career. But I've played here and there. I've subbed the last couple of years. I still enjoy it. It's a good time to, you know, sort of pretend that you still have a little bit of athleticism in your dying 40-something husk of a body. And, you know, that's what's good about it. But I agree with you. It's not really it's not something I'm as passionate about maybe as I once was. But this was quite great. Hellfire Field, tremendous moment for us to rally and win the first game and at least get into this swing off, which was because we were split to games 1 and 2. Gosh, that was so fun. I love that we won. We never win. The media never wins that thing. It's like it just doesn't.
It's not designed for the media to win.
No, we are there to have a good time.
Yeah,
and be the Washington Senators. No. What's the team that plays the Harlem Globetrotters? That's
the Washington
Generals.
You got
Generals.
It. You know ball.
Yeah. That's kind of what we are, but not this time. Not this time. David Goh, CBS 58 intern. Thank you for your service, sir. You did a marvelous job. Any last thoughts before we go?
No.
And we're out. That's it. So here's my interview now with Gorman Thomas, also Kelly Call, producer for Just a Bit Outside, this 1982 Brewers movie. If it's your sort of thing, it's a long interview. So if you want to check out, by all means, you know, move on. That's fine. It's a pretty lengthy interview with both those guys asking a little bit about the movie, the 1982 team, of course. And if you want to check that out, it's going to begin playing in Milwaukee Marcus Cinemas on the 13th this week. So it's kind of cool. I'm going to check it out. I'm not going to probably swear by it because the territory is well trod, but maybe not. Maybe it surprises me. So we will check that out. Thanks for listening to this edition of Microbrew. We'll talk to you again next week. Bye. My guests are Kelly Call, producer of the movie Just a Bit Outside, and I guess one of the stars of the movie, Gorman Thomas, that Brewers fans know well, outfielder for a long time, but certainly on the 1982 Milwaukee Brewers. And I wanted to talk a little bit about this movie that's going to go wide, or at least Milwaukee-wide, on September 13th, where fans can check out the documentary about the 1982 Milwaukee Brewers team. Kelly, I will start with you because I know you have a long history in entertainment. You are from Wisconsin, so I can draw the conclusion as to why this was an important story for you to tell. But what made this particular... you know, this particular team, this particular era, sort of a passion project for you, and also how did you get it done? Like, I'm assuming some of your connections came into play there.
Well, I think it started out just because, you know, I was a teenager in 82, and, you know, Brewers were my team, and, you know, I think I kind of recognized the team for, you know, what they were, which was this, You know, it was kind of like they were Buccaneers. They were pirates. They were free spirits. And, you know, I loved them. And, you know, without getting gushy, my favorite guy was Gorman Thomas. And so I'm playing high school baseball. I'm wearing my stirrups like Gorman does. I'm taking big cuts at the plate like Gorman. And, you know, that was my team. And I don't know what were 10, 12 years ago, I got a chance to play golf with Gorman, and I was, you know, damn excited about it. And nervous, to be very honest. And you know, we got out there, and you know, with as nervous as I was, within a hole or two, it felt like, you know, old friends. And Gorman had a story for every hole, sometimes a couple stories for every hole. A lot of them involve, you know, late nights in Detroit or Boston or Kansas City. And, you know, then I had the kind of honor of playing with him a couple more times. And I guess over time, this, you know, story after story, I said, you know what, there's something interesting here. These guys were able to go out. They had a unique chemistry, one. Two, they were able to kind of really go out in a way that teams can't do now. You know, you can't roll 11 deep with your team into a bar, you know, at midnight on the road anymore without people sticking cameras in your face. So, you know, I talked to my buddy, Sean Hanisch, who's the other producer and our director. He was also from Wisconsin. He was at a lot of the games in 82 because his family had season tickets. And we sat down, had a couple beers. And I said, I think there's something here. And we decided we would let's start talking to these guys if we can get a hold of them. And we started talking to everybody by phone first. We did kind of a phone interview and started taking notes. And the more we talked and the more we learned, the more we thought there was some, not only something here, but something new that people hadn't heard before.
So Gorman, I'm curious how the process unfolded on your end. If you were part of the equation here, calling former teammates, getting them involved and kind of just the nuts and bolts of what it was to have these guys come to your home. I assume it was your home and how, you know, how it all developed for you.
Well, that's Kelly had it all right there. You know, we crossed the line to get out on the field and beat whomever we were playing. And then after that, a bunch of guys go and we have a, you know, a milkshake. How about that? But like Kelly said, that, you know, we kind of, you know, cut it together down at the Lake Geneva with the golf. But, you know, we laughed about it. And then I found out what he did with CBS and SEAL team. That was my favorite one. He says, I'll take care of it. I had hats. I had shirts. I mean, it was just funny. It was just funny. And it's been that long. And, hopefully it'll be a long time yet.
So he mentioned that this is, Kelly mentioned that this is different, you know, maybe adding something that we haven't seen before. What do you think that is, Gorman, based on, I mean, you've been part of a lot of 1982 fanfare, you've been welcomed back to the stadium a bunch of times. There've been a lot of retellings of this story. From what you know about this production, what do you feel like is the element that we maybe haven't seen before, or that you just think is a little bit of a different angle?
Well, the real deal is that he sent it to me. I've seen the movie. I didn't see the trailer. I saw with my wife Susie. We watched the movie. It was absolutely awesome. I'm telling you, I couldn't tell the guys or any other people, you know, what it was, but I can tell you what it might come out to be. And you know, picking on different people, you know. You know, if you don't talk to Kelly, I'm going to call your wife. You know, stayed out, had too many beers or whatever it was. But, you know, it was just wonderful. And to me, it's kind of like yesterday. I can, you know, tell you what the lineup was, who was going to be the starter, who's going to be the middle guy, and who's going to, you know, shut it down at the end of the game. But just the way we played, and God, some of the guys, you know, I've known them for a long time because I started up here in 1973. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's these guys are just, I mean, they're like your brothers. I mean, we were in a situation like it is in was in 82. We had to win the last game of the season to get into the playoffs. Then we had to win the last game against the Angels to get to the series. And then we got the seventh game. We had a lot of thought was going to happen because we knew how to don't get worried about it. Just go out there and do your job. But that last game in Baltimore, I mean, that one there right there, Robin hits two home runs right away. And I took a home run away from Singleton, you know, dead center right there in Memorial Stadium. But I mean, there were so many things. I mean, I've tried to write a book, you know, a couple times, you know, and lost it. But when Kelly put this on here, you want to try this? You betcha. Let's go. So that's what we did.
Kelly, I imagine they're going to be Wisconsin fans who are wondering how this compares to, I guess, a normal documentary, I'll put that in air quotes, if this is the type of thing that's going to be shown in theaters outside of Wisconsin, if it'll be on a streaming service, if fans are unable to get to one of the Marcus Theater spots that are first showing it. Is there a way to sort of contextualize that? Like how big this will end up being? And if there's stuff in there that will speak to audiences that aren't just lifelong Milwaukee Brewers fans.
Yeah, we're kind of focusing first on, you know, Marcus Theaters they've been great partners to us, and they saw the movie and immediately said, we want to put this on in Wisconsin. And that was our first, I guess, goal was, can we show it to the real fans? And that, you know, mostly the fans of Wisconsin. Of course, immediately, you know, I'm getting texts and emails and tweets from people in Georgia and Alabama saying, well, hey, how come I don't get to see this? So We'll figure something out, either a streaming deal or, you know, if things go crazy, maybe there's a theatrical run. But we are very mindful of the folks outside the state, and we want to be able to – we know there are Brewer fans everywhere, and we want to make sure we get it in front of them at some point. And I think the other thing that, you know, we found is you don't necessarily need to be a Brewers fan or – you know, we've shown this to some people who were very familiar with the story – and some people who really had no idea what the story was. And the story, because the season tracks like a movie, the way it starts and the poor the high expectations and the poor start. And then, you know, then the managerial change and Harvey comes in and the team takes off. And then it still goes down to the last game of the season, the ALCS, the World Series. You know, we were kind of, Sean and I were laughing. We're like, you couldn't really write this any better. I mean, it almost defies logic. But I think there are some just universal human, you know, these guys, none of them walk around with a cloud over their head, but Game 7 still resonates with these guys. And I think that's kind of a universal, you know, human feeling that people can relate to.
Gorman, he mentioned that managerial change. I think one of my favorite stats from that season is you end up tying Reggie Jackson for the league lead in home runs, but had no home runs in April. The April and May experience of 1982 was so different from everything that followed. And there's two flashpoints. There's the change in the manager shift from Buck Rogers to Harvey Keene. And then there's the acquisition of Don Sutton for the final month of the season that obviously pays dividends too. I think today it's kind of wonder how much power a manager has over a team, you know, if changing a manager really does create a culture change or help, you know, help a team, you know, pivot. I don't know if it was different in 1982, but obviously something shifted when Harvey Keene came on board. Are you able, I mean, when people ask you about that, did that really make a difference? Was it coincidental? Obviously he brought something to the table that you didn't have before. So how would you describe that? How things shifted for you when he came on board?
Well, there's so many streets I could take off and just say this. But first of all, I've got to say about George Bamberger, when he came here in 1978, the Brewers never, I don't even know how many had a good year, maybe 70, maybe 65, you know, for the season. George came here, he changed everything around. He was one of the guys. He was just one of the guys with the players and also the fans outside, you know, when the game was gone. But he had a heart, so he had to go. Then here comes Buck. And Buck, there was Buck was a great guy. I mean, just a great guy. But maybe he wanted to change his, do this here. And I might as well go ahead and say it. I mean, he moved me from center to right. And, mm-hmm. you know, it was not a problem. It was not a problem, but some people wanted to make it a problem. So that was nothing. But we weren't, for something we just weren't, we weren't just doing what we should be doing. We were trying, but it wasn't work. And then that day in Seattle, when Harvey had, oh, by the way, I'm the new manager. We're going to have one meeting because I don't like meetings. So let's go out and kick somebody's ass. And I think we had a big, you know, a lot of runs that first game. And then when Uncle Harvey, I mean, he was just one of us. I mean, he was one of us. And here we came. We were in what, sixth and on the, you know, in the standings. And then all of a sudden, here we come. Here comes trouble. We go out, we kick people's butt, and we enjoyed it, and we wanted to do it every damn day. So that's what we did. So, I mean, he was just awesome. I cannot say, or I never would ever say anything about Buck. Buck was a good guy, good ball player. It just happens. It just happens.
You know, JR, nobody in trying to tell the story, you know, none of the players really were interested in having anything bad to say about Buck. And mm-hmm. I think, interestingly, he was probably almost more of a new school manager. Like he would be more of a manager today, I think. But the sense I certainly got was this team, you know, just did not, you know, did not want the leash held tight on these guys. These were veteran players. And I think Harvey came in and he let go of the leash and just let these guys run. And they went with it. And I think it took the pressure off because I think the expectations going into the season were super high. And I think maybe they felt that pressure a little bit. And Harvey just said, guys, go play. And they really, really responded.
Absolutely.
And Harvey is, you know, you said he's kind of one of you guys. He has a bar in West Allis. You know, he's such a folk hero kind of in Milwaukee. And I wonder for both of you guys, because I imagine part of this documentary is really showing how the city and the team interacted. And I don't think that's the type of thing you can get quite on that level today, because you said it earlier, cameras would be in their faces, their social media. Guys can't just go out and drink among the fans of Milwaukee. And I don't know if that's really what happened, Gorman, and you can sort of tell me what it was like being a Milwaukeean then, but it feels like, Gorman, and you've seen this evolve over time, it feels like you guys had an access and a sort of opportunity to be among the people of Milwaukee more than any player would today in pro sports. Does that sound right?
Well, there's a lot of things that have changed in baseball right now. I mean, some of these new rules and stuff, the one that I don't like is the top of the 10th inning.
yes.
Everything's guy on second base with nobody out. I mean, what is that all about? I mean, I hear that people, they want people to, you know, make it happen faster. Wait a minute. You're going to the ballpark for one thing, to have a good time, see the game, good food. I mean, just relaxing and everything. But, you know, it's changed so much in that, you know, in that replace. But, you know, the managers don't play. They put the lineup on the wall. This is who's playing, boom, 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 boom. We were fortunate from 78 to 82. We knew who was playing every day. We had pretty well, you know, in the same slot on the lineup. But nowadays, I mean, it's always changing around. It's just changing mm-hmm. around. But the players, you know, have to produce. It can't be the manager. You know, if he gets all the heat if they lose. But if they win, you know, you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, look at our guy right now. I mean, it's, what were they, 20 over pride? Or not pride, but, you know, 20 inches. I mean, whatever it is. But, you know, he was one guy. He was in college, and then he went other places and everything, was a coach and everything. And he knows all about baseball, and he lets his guys play. And that's great. He's having a great day, having a great year.
Kelly, did you film a lot in Milwaukee? Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Kelly.
I was going to say, you know, part of what we try to do with this movie is also, you know, it was a team, but we also tried to contextualize the time a little bit. This is Milwaukee in 1982, and plants are closing, and Schlitz goes away, and, you know, my grandfather worked at Alice Chalmers. They shut down, and so here's this city that's really kind of down on its luck, and then along comes this team, which kind of lifts the spirit of everybody up. And then in addition, you know, these are guys who are out in bars. You could see them out after games. They were kind of a team of the people. They would, you know, walk through the parking lot and, you know, from what we would hear, sometimes have a beer with the fans after the game. We heard this pretty regularly. So I think the city felt, you know, in a different way than maybe now, that this was literally their team.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I showed up at the ballpark for a night game. I would probably get to the ballpark, you know, somewhere around, you know, around noon, 1 o'clock. People are coming in, you know, they got the everything set out, you know, bring it out. I'd have a burgers and stuff like that, you know, and some Pepsi. I like Pepsi. So I would have that, and it was awesome. And then after the game was over, you might have something else, you know, off of the ice. But it was just being around the fans we had. Because we started playing, like I said, 78. So, I mean, the fans were there. They were great, you know, blah, 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 you know, and the people out in the center. If I did something that I didn't do at the time at bat, and I was out there yelling at myself, the people out there in the center, you know, they start cheering, go over them and do it next time. Go, boom, boom, boom. And I started laughing about it, you know, and it was nice. It was nice. So, you know, I don't think you could ever have a better place to play. Mm.
Kelly, as you put this story together, there's so many moments that I feel like made this so special. You know, we've talked about the change in manager and the team sort of shifting. There is that last game in Baltimore where things could have gone all the way south, that final series against the Orioles. There's Cecil Cooper's hit. Is there a sliding doors moment that you kind of stumbled upon or came upon that you thought, wow, like if this really could have gone a different direction if this had happened, or because this happened, things went right for them? Was there something that really struck you that maybe you weren't even aware of going into it?
There were a couple things in the World Series that I think, a couple games that could have, you know, a couple plays that could have turned things a different way. Game two with the game tied in the eighth.
Bill Holland.
Pete Ladd throws a pitch, a beautiful pitch on the outside corner, which should have been the third out of the inning. Instead, it's called a ball, and the gentleman gets a walk. And, you know, it unnerved Pete Ladd a little bit. And then he walked the next guy in and gave them the go-ahead run. And that's a game that, you know, I think Gorman will say everybody thought if we could have got to the ninth tied, we would have had a good shot. And then, you know, game seven, it's very loud and Lonnie Smith is up and Vuk's pitching, and Robin and Paul had little signs back and forth, a whistle. Robin would look for the sign and then relay it to Paul, you know, inside fastball, outside, you know, slider, what have you. And they said in this one play, it was so loud that Paul did not kind of catch the little whistle or the chirp from Robin. And as a result, he did not take the step he normally would have taken toward the line. And then Lonnie Smith rips one down the line, you know, that far outside his glove. If he's there and catches it, you know, inning over. But, you know, ended up being a double down the line. And then, you know, that's how the Cardinals, you know, eventually got ahead. So they're just these, you know, little moments, little things. And that's, I think that was the, for Sean and I, that was the interesting thing to find out. We knew about these moments, but we didn't know kind of the impact they really had.
How about from your perspective, Gorman? I don't know how often you think of that that call by Bill Haller behind home plate. Lonnie Smith thought he was out on that strike three. I think it was Lonnie Smith who was batting at that point. Anything else jump to mind for you?
Well, I think it was I thought it was Hendricks. He was the one who, I think it was one ball, two strikes. Pete, like you said, you know, it was a strike. It was a strike. Umpire called it a ball. Next pitch, he swung, hit it off the end of the bat. It just kind of just finding a hole between first and second. And that was it, because at that time, not sure exactly what the how the runs were, but that was it. That would have been it right there. So, you know, it was sad. It was, and you know, I might as well say it. I mean, I made the last out, right? I think I fouled off five or six pitches off of Suter. He was in the top three in baseball at that point in time. And then I chased the high fastball. I didn't want to be the last one. I mean, it wasn't going to be. I mean, even if I had tried to hit a home run, it wouldn't have made any difference because we were down a couple runs. So two outs and that. And as I came back into the dugout, and that poor bat didn't last it any longer. Helmet was first, and then I broke the bat first. Bo Jackson's not the only one that did that. So, but I mean, it was such a wonderful, wonderful thing. I mean, the way we had to do to get to where we were at the end, and then after it was all over, Mr. Sealing, he says, you know, oh, by the way, everybody needs to be downtown tomorrow morning, whatever the time was. And we got inside the building, you know, and all these old, I mean, really, really nice cars. And I could tell you 100 stories right there with me and Vuk on it. Oh, my Lord. But over 1 million people were there. I mean, that just shows you where the people are. So
yeah,
we enjoyed playing for them.
As getting close to the end here, Gorman, what are you doing now? I know you are at the ballpark a lot. Are you living in the area? I don't know. I see the South Carolina copper behind you. What are you up to these days?
Well, my wife and I, we have a barbecue sauce. It's called Storman sauce. Okay. I played golf. I was, actually I was on a tour for 20 years. So I did that all over the place. I have, 4 grandchildren. Oh God. One of them went to, high school for the first time yesterday. The other ones already. Yeah, I know. And then we got 2 little ones. You know, I got 15, 13, 7, and 4. So they keep us, you know, busy all the time and everything. And, you know, I could go on and on and on and on. But, you know, it's just wonderful, you know. And Susie and I, we're just having a nice time.
Kelly, what else should we know about the movie before I let you guys go?
Well, I also want to quickly vouch for Gorman sauce, which I order and have sent out here because it is tremendous on brats. It is good on a salad. It is good with some pulled pork. It is phenomenal stuff. So I encourage everybody to look for it. And anytime we serve it here, people are like, what is this? This is phenomenal. But anyway, our movie is called Just a Bit Outside. It's coming to the Marcus Theaters on September 13th. Not just most of the Milwaukee area Marcus Theaters, but also Racine, Madison, Oshkosh, Appleton, Green Bay, and Sheboygan, I think. So
great.
I think it packs a punch, and I know anybody who'll go who has memories of that 82 team will walk out with a smile on their face.
All right, he's producer Kelly Call, Brewers legend Gorman Thomas as well. Hopefully you get a chance to catch Just a Bit Outside. Thank you for joining us, guys. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, JR.